This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
I know this steak doesn't exist. I know that when I put it in my mouth, the Matrix is telling my brain that it is juicy and delicious. After 9 years, you know what I realize? Ignorance is bliss.
Admit it, Adam. You'd sell out the human race for a bite of that steak.
I don't know. Is it medium?
You get medium rare.
Oh,
you got to go medium rare, Adam.
We're off to a rough start.
Why am I not shocked? This week on the show, our top five movie meals. Adam, I got us reservations for two at the Double R Diner. I hear they've got great pie.
Pie. Can we agree on pie, if not steak?
I mean... Pie's okay.
Oh, man. Plus, Josh has been tuning in to Marvel's WandaVision, and you have thoughts, that and more.
Catherine Hahn, those are my thoughts.
Quick review ahead on Film Spotting. Welcome to Film Spotting with Josh and Adam. Film Spotting Madness, best of the 80s, Josh. We started, as we do, with 64 films. This week, we are down to 16. Not a whole lot of memorable movie meals among those remaining titles, though.
I had, you know, in my runners-up, as I was putting my list together, a slice of Sal's Pizza from Do the Right Thing. Then I remembered Pantheon title, not eligible, so couldn't include it.
Yeah, there's also a steak and Raging Bull, speaking of Pantheon titles, that I think ends up on the floor. Probably still tasty, as long as it's medium, Josh. Later... In the show, podcast listeners will get our thoughts on round two madness results and the Sweet 16 matchups. Radio listeners, you can always get the full version of the show at filmspotting.net or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's start by setting the table for this week's top five movie meals by repraising the film that inspired it, The Truffle Hunters. This is now playing in select theaters. It had a limited, very limited qualifying release last year, and it's a film because of that qualifying release, Adam, that made your top 10 of 2020. It's a documentary about the rare Alba truffle and the men who hunt the Italian forests for them. These men, it's worth noting, they're in their 70s and 80s, a long-standing tradition that they're a part of. Now, in my voting for the Chicago Film Critics Association Awards, Adam, I nominated The Truffle Hunters in the documentary, foreign language, and cinematography categories. Clearly a movie I went for, but you liked it even more than me, putting it on your top 10 list. So remind us why.
Yeah, top 10 list, and also a more prestigious award than anything that we would nominate for the CFCA. In our 2020 wrap party, I had it as my number one funniest moment of the year, which doesn't speak to really any of the true magic of The Truffle Hunters, other than it does have a very sly sense of humor. I'll give it some credit for that, maybe more sly than we would usually equate with your typical documentary. But there is an end scene that is an absolute howler. I know you felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely talked about this movie a fair amount going back to those end of year shows. And I think what stands out in my mind, beyond the fact that there is at least one great meal scene, too, where we watch not a critic so much as maybe a food writer, I think he is.
Yeah, something like that.
We just watch in one of those great tableaus that the movie is composed on, sits and eats a meal. It's an egg with some kind of fondue, and they shave that truffle on top. And it was one of those moments of last year where I certainly saw that and instantly wanted to devour it. But it really is the overall aesthetic approach that impressed me so much with the Truffle Hunters, because it's just gorgeously shot, truly gorgeous and atypical, as I mentioned, in that it's not so much trying to capture the everyday life of these men and this quest as it is trying to render it in kind of a magical way, because there's something kind of magical about this truffle, why it tastes so good, why so many people seek it out, how hard it is to get, and the way you get it, where you have to have dogs basically sniff it out. And maybe it just surprised me, Josh, too, not only for all the ways that it's unconventional as a documentary, but I went in thinking, based on the brief plot description that I'd read, that I was basically going to watch people sort of competing to find the most truffles or the biggest truffle. And that would have been compelling enough, but it really is more about these idiosyncratic men and their dogs and these kind of absurd but fascinating lives that they lead.
It's that word you used for me, tableau, because that is really what you get in the portraits of these men. Frequent scenes of them, just, you know, the camera holding on a frame that had to have been composed in some way. We talked about this a little bit, right? How much of it was just captured, how much of it might have been composed, and just these gorgeous images of these men either at work or in repose after they've been talking to the camera about their craft. It's just one of the more beautiful documentaries I've seen. And that's why I, you know, mention it in the cinematography category. And that's actually, Adam, when we're thinking about this list, cinematography, top five movie meals, cinematography was one of the ingredients I had to consider when it came to this list. I don't know. How about you?
Yeah. Well, I certainly going to spend some time talking about camera choices with my picks, but I didn't think of it necessarily as an ingredient, Josh, that had to be there. One thing we didn't talk about with Truffle Hunters that I'll touch on really quickly, there are a couple scenes, maybe one notable one anyway, that I'm thinking of, where it's not one of those tableaus. And it's where they put a GoPro, I think, or something like a GoPro, onto one of the dogs.
Yeah.
And it sniffs out these truffles. And it's a nice little touch and breaks up the overall aesthetic approach. It did occur to me later, too, that I wonder if it was actually a practical choice, because maybe that dog was going somewhere that you actually couldn't go. You couldn't maneuver in that space, or maybe even get up that hill, or just exactly to that space where the dog can go to seek it out. Obviously, eventually, his owner is going to have to come by and try to scoop up the truffle, but I really did like that choice.
The dogs are so great. I mean, I wish I had a career, a vocation that depended that much on a dog. For some reason, podcasting and writing, my dog isn't much help with that, but it'd be great if you had that sort of job.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and get into our main course then. We'll start it off anyway. We're talking about movie meals, and you mentioned part of your criteria here, Josh. I want to hear what else you considered and whether or not specifically you focused on great movie scenes that involve meals or memorable uses of food and meal settings, or did you really think about the food?
Combination. So here are my three ingredients to a good movie meal, Adam. I mentioned the first one, the cinematography. It's got to look good. And yeah, the camera work, it sounds like you might get into, is part of that. So I could broaden that to say the filmmaking, right? The presentation, the cinematic presentation.
Well done.
Okay, that's ingredient number one. The second thing is some sort of narrative or thematic resonance. So somehow it at least ties into the other things the movie is interested in or reflects it. It doesn't have to be like hammering the nail moment where it solidifies that theme, but it somehow reflects it, somehow relates. So that's ingredient number two. Number three, it's got to be a dish I love. I mean, this is a very visceral, carnal sort of list we're putting together here, right? So if I'm not responding to the food that I'm actually seeing, I'm sorry, I might appreciate what it's doing for other people who like that dish, but it's not going to make my top five.
Yeah, so I'm with you there. I think I made it much easier, Josh. I focused on just that final ingredient for the most part. It really had to start there anyway. How much did I wish I could change places with these characters? And I'll be clear, maybe only for the moment when they're consuming this food and no other moment in the film, including before or just after. But in that moment, I am envious that I'm not having that exact same experience. And actually, a longtime listener, friend of the show, Josh Youngerman, he just wrote in about an hour ago, Josh, my list fully formed, but he articulated so nicely how I approached it and had a very good pick, even though it's actually a blind spot for me. Josh says, while as I've grown older, I've stopped considering this film one of his great works, although I am excited to revisit it, the blueberry pie that Jude Law makes Nora Jones' character in Wong Kar-wai's My Blueberry Nights has to be on the list. Few directors are able to capture food in the way Wong Kar-wai does. After seeing it, I went straight to the local all-night cafe where I went to college and ordered blueberry pie myself. So that's it. You have to have that type of reaction, that visceral reaction, as you said, where you're like, I need that food right now.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Maybe the most important ingredient for sure.
Okay. Your number five.
My number five is the sushi bento box in Isle of Dogs. Now, granted, I'm going to acknowledge right at the top, there is a dab of wasabi poison. I don't know if that's really a thing, but it does have a little dollop of wasabi poison. Okay. But as we're going to see, Adam, as I get further into my list, that doesn't, that's not always a bad thing for me.
Interesting.
So this sushi preparation scene, it's just one of the many examples of the exquisitely detailed stop motion animation in Wes Anderson's 2018 film. It has this overhead shot of a counter, and all we see are the chef's hands. He's quickly, precisely preparing the sashimi, the rolls, all the rest that go into this box. And yes, I know what you might be thinking already is like, well, it's animated. How compelling could that be? But this just speaks to the level of detail going on by Anderson's team here. If you're a sushi fan, you're going to recognize, you know, every cut, every line. You can probably almost identify which fish they're actually slicing up here. And it does make your mouth water. Now, I want to point out, you know, some have found this and the other references to Japanese culture in Isle of Dogs to veer towards cultural appropriation. But as I said at the time when we reviewed it, I really think this sushi sequence, and I would include the taiko drumming on the soundtrack, the frequent use of Japanese script, the landscapes we see that recall woodblock prints, I take that all closer to being cultural appreciation. And I do think that's crucial to the larger political project that I see in Isle of Dogs. So this is a movie that came out. It's a movie that, first of all, is about the deportation of a targeted group, in this case, yes, dogs, but it came out at a low point in American policy toward immigrants. I mean, think about what was happening at the U.S.-Mexico border in 2018. And so I think it's helpful to layer a parable about cruel immigration policy with appreciation for the beauty and intricacy of a different, and by that I mean non-white, culture. I think that was that was important for American audiences in particular. So I realize I veered away from the food. That's a lot to pack in a bento box. But I really, this sequence really does make me want to order some sushi. So Isle of Dogs hits all my check marks for a great movie meal.
Okay. Well, we're going to stick with Japan and we're going to stick with animation, though, just like the poisonous wasabi that makes it tempting, but a little bit dangerous to eat. That's definitely going to apply to the roasted meats that we're going to talk about in Miyazaki's Spirited Away. I'm also going to touch on the rice ball that plays a very prominent role in the film. And I'll admit that this probably is the only choice on my list where that scale is tipped a little bit more in favor of the way food is used versus how badly I want to eat it myself. Maybe I'm just not into roasted meat as much as the next guy, but I will mention that there are so many Miyazaki movies, first of all, that you could choose from, right? We rewatched these as a family over the past year of quarantine. I think about The Ham, and there's more meat in Ponyo, and more meat, bacon in Howl's Moving Castle, Calcifer's Breakfast with the eggs. But the one that does stand out the most for me is Spirited Away. Of course, the whole inciting incident of the movie is the young heroine Chihiro losing her parents because they become pigs and she has to go off and find them and see how she can reverse that curse. And in that scene, where they're wandering that space. It's totally deserted. And all of a sudden, they come across the sizzle of food being cooked, these huge plates of amazing looking cuisine, and there's no one else around. So what are you going to do, Josh, but not decide that it's a feast that's been created exactly for you? And you know why I love these scenes and why I love Miyazaki so much is it's such a fantastical world. It's these Miyazaki dreamscapes. I've described the experience of watching Miyazaki movies as one where it almost feels like you're seeing a child's imagination unlock in real time. You know, some new creature or place is just being conjured in the moment. But there's this underlying humanity that grounds it all and makes it relatable. And here are those parents. They are being tempted a little bit against their will, perhaps. There's something supernatural that's drawing them to that food. But seeing all of it, wanting to devour it the way they do. Yes, there's a gluttonous aspect to it, but who among us isn't guilty of a little gluttony from time to time?
Oh, it's delicious. Chihiro, you have to taste this.
I don't want any. We're going to get in trouble. Let's just get out of here.
Don't worry. You've got Daddy here. He's got credit cards and cash.
So I definitely relate to the parents there in that scene. And then we get that wonderfully touching moment, Josh, a bit later in the movie, where she's now sitting outside the barn where her parents, the pigs, are. Her entire world has been turned upside down. She's lonely. She's scared. She's exhausted. And the one character, Haku, who has come to help her, offers her some food. It's a rice ball, onigiri. And just as she bites into it, she starts to cry. You want to talk about relatable? Who hasn't sought solace and comfort in food before, right? And the ironic juxtaposition of the sadness she's feeling and expressing while simultaneously shoving food in her face. And you also get the sense that she's crying, maybe even just at the act of generosity and sympathy in a world that doesn't make any sense. And where, since she's been there, she's the target of such animosity. It makes it such a small but profound moment.
Yeah, great scene. Love Spirited Away. And I'm so glad that we're each going to have a Studio Ghibli representation here on our list, because you'd have to go with, there's so many options, as you said. I even in researching and trying to remind myself, I came across a supercut on YouTube of Studio Ghibli food scene. So maybe we'll link to that in the in the show notes. But my pick isn't my number four. So I'll hold off there. You may have mentioned it. You may have given it a little bit away there, Adam, but
apologies.
I'll get to mine in a little bit. At number four, well, there was a time when Beasts of the Southern Wild appeared on, I don't know, every other top five list I did. Does that sound right, Adam? I think that's how things went for a few years there. It's been a while. I've laid off, but the time has come again, because my number four movie meal is the fried alligator that little hush puppy is served about midway through the film, I think it is, by this mysterious mother figure when she's aboard the floating bar Elysian Fields.
I'm going to tell you something. When you're a child, people tell you that life is going to be all happy and honky-dory and all that bullshit, but I'm here to tell you that is not. So you need to get that out your head right now. Because, yeah, life's some big old feast, but you ain't nothing but a stupid little waitress. One day, everything on your plate going to fall on the floor. Ain't nobody going to be there to pick it up for you. One day, it's going to be all on you. You understand what I'm saying?
Kvanjane Wallace, she plays Hush Puppy, of course, and Jovan Hathaway is the cook in this scene, who welcomes this lonely child into her kitchen, gives her food, gives her, you know, a side of life advice as well. It's beautifully filmed by the director here, Ben Zeitlin. The bits of flower that catch the light as it floats in the air, and that reminds us, it's a callback to earlier in the film when we were told how Hush Puppy's mother, before she left her, would make this very same meal. So this whole sequence captures what meals can mean to us emotionally, especially, I think, the ones that we had in childhood. And one of the things that Beasts of the Southern Wild traces is childhood being taken away too soon. Now, about the meal itself, have you ever had alligator of any sort, Adam?
Yeah, I have.
Was it
actually
good? Was it good?
Iowa. I remember taking my now wife, then girlfriend, out to a fancy dinner at a New Orleans inspired.
Yeah, right.
And
of course,
they had alligator as an appetizer, and we said we're going to go for it. And I remember quite liking it, Josh.
Okay. Good, especially in that scenario, because it reminds me, I was just driving through Western Illinois, and in the middle of all these like farm fields, I saw some sort of like Cajun restaurant. I was kind of like, I don't think this is where I'm going to eat Cajun, but I'm glad that you had a good experience. I've had good and bad with fried alligator, to be honest. I've been to play. Okay. I mean, it's really tough. It can be really, it's tough meat, right? And so it can be a little dicey, but I've also had it at places where it's just delicious. So I genuinely do like this meal. And, you know, in this scene, seeing how lovingly prepared it is, pretty sure it would taste amazing.
Well, look how cultured you are. I've had alligator but once, way too many years ago. You can't even remember all the times you've had it.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I will say the best alligator I've had, not Iowa, but Florida. So okay. I don't know.
That does sound more appropriate. We did not coordinate these picks at all, but there's great symmetry so far through our first two choices, because my number four film and movie meal is one that would be right at home in Beasts of the Southern Wild. And actually, that reminds me, I have to go back. You're really lucky, Josh, that we're recording these shows now remote and we're no longer in the studio, because if you recall, I actually had installed a buzzer to electroshock you every time you reference Beasts of the Southern Wild.
That's right. Somehow I had forgotten about that. I wonder if that button is still there, if they've had it removed. Huh.
I'm guessing so. My number four comes from the 2010 Luca Guadagnino movie, I Am Love. And here's where we get the crossover to your pick, Josh. I'm calling the scene what star Tilda Swinton calls it, which is pornography. Here's where we're going to get the carnal. You mentioned the carnal. Mm. Oh, that's what this scene's all about. And yes, it does revolve all around prawns. And of course, as I was thinking about this pick today and Guadagnino's other really memorable film, Call Me By Your Name, he does like to use food. Let's just leave it at that.
Peaches?
Well, that's where I was going, Josh. There are none in this scene, though. Again, we're talking about food and carnality, but this is Tilda Swinton's Emma, who had met a friend of her son earlier in the film. His name's Antonio. He's a chef at a dinner party at her house. And later, she takes a couple of friends to this posh lunch at Antonio's restaurant. And the scene mostly revolves around Emma Swinton and her reaction to the food, beholding it, the way she sees it, the way she actually physically consumes it. But we do see some of the prep, Josh, the clear intent and even perhaps a little bit of the sensuality that goes into it from Antonio's side. You can tell that he has a purpose and that he is there to try and impress her, to try to transport her. Yes, probably even to seduce her. And he is successful. The first dish he brings out, it's a new one. He's been inspired by her. And it's called Leghorn Style Cod. And we then cut to her, Swinton, in that red dress. Everything around her, including her guests, are pretty sterile looking, pretty nondescript. She is so alive already before the food even comes out, with her reddish hair and that red dress. And then she takes that first bite, and you can tell the way she eats it that she doesn't really even have a second thought about it until she actually tastes it. That smile. That smile we've all had, where you taste something that is both delicious but completely unexpected, like something that just catches you totally by surprise, the way food can. And then the next course comes out, and it's marinated egg yolk, pea cream, and zucchini flowers, and the prawns with ratatouille and sweet and sour sauce. Oh, yes, and mixed fish with crunchy vegetables, just in case you were still hungry. And at first, it's pretty traditionally shot. We'll get into the cinematography here. Medium shots, close-ups. But then when the plate is put down and she considers it and the care that was put into it and how incredible it looks, we then cut to the extreme close-up of her eyes. And this is the moment where these two people, who are separated by kitchen walls and who knows how many feet, and haven't even seen each other yet, I don't think, in the restaurant, this is where the seduction really does begin. And it's all through the food that he's crafted for her. Something unspoken is being communicated through the meal. And we see in the sound design and the way it's shot, all of their conversation, all of their thought, all of their people drift away. And this is just now the experience that she's having with him through that food. The light glows around her as she touches it with her fork. The slow motion cutting into the prawn and biting it. Josh, maybe Top Gun's on my mind, but Take My Breath Away could be playing as she cuts into the prawn. Okay, there's less tongue. There's less tongue.
Oh, please. But now you ruined it.
We get a wider shot of the table. We see now she really is almost literally the only person in the restaurant. Everyone else is silhouetted. She's bathed in that light. And we get that attention to the sound I mentioned, the clinking of the fork on the plate, even her lips as she chews the food, which sounds like it would be horrible, but it's Tilda Swinton, so it's kind of exquisite. The way she closes her eyes and savors every bite. And we've all been there, or at least I hope we all have, where you've tasted something that really does make you slow down for a second and ponder every chew because you don't want it to end. And I was looking up some information about this movie today. The New York Times called it a foodie movie in an article. They said some of the scenes were inspired by Ratatouille, the movie, the Pixar film. Maybe that's why we get the use of that dish with the prawns. But the chef who served as a culinary advisor is Carlo Cracco of Milan's Cracco Restaurant. And in that article, he said really succinctly what I was alluding to before. He calls food a tool to express the utter giving that a lover can display to the other without words. Who knew, Josh? And if you didn't know, you know it after watching I Am Love.
Well, that's also got to be such a tough scene to pull off for an actor because it is a cliche scene, right? How many movies have that of the pause, you know, put the bite in the mouth, close the eyes.
Right.
But you're going to need someone like Swinton to layer it and make it sing in a new way. And as you described, the filmmaking adds to that as well, of course. All right. My number three is Kai de Sarcophage in Babette's Feast. Now, as the title indicates, the meal that's at the climax of this 1987 Danish film, it's from director Gabriel Axel. It's the whole point of the movie. So to really go into this one would be to give the entire film away. And I know it's 30 some years old, but still, you know, fair amount of people probably haven't seen it. So I'm going to dance around this a little bit.
Please do, Josh, as it remains an embarrassing blind spot for me as
okay.
we're doing this top five.
All right. It's like one of the major foodie movies, right? Basically set in the late 1800s in this strict religious community in Denmark, where even food, I mean, speaking of carnal, like food of any sort that's providing you any sort of pleasure beyond basic sustenance is suspicious as this carnal pleasure. Now, these two adult sisters, as the movie goes on, they're the daughters, actually, of the late pastor who used to preside over the community. They take in this French refugee as a servant, and her culinary skills just begin to challenge this thinking as the movie goes on. Basically, Babette's Feast, it moves from an understanding of food and cooking as forms of gluttony to seeing them as outlets for creativity, hospitality, and even in ways I don't want to spoil, opportunities for grace. Now, as for the feast itself, this wasn't an immediate choice for me. I think when we were talking a little bit on Slack, I was like, I don't know. I know it's a foodie movie, but I'm not so sure because I couldn't honestly remember the details of the meal that Babette, and she's played by Stephanie Audran, that she makes. I knew it was some sort of like rich French cuisine. And then I saw on Twitter, because we did put out calls for suggestions on Twitter and Facebook, got a ton of great responses. But Gabriel Lobb, his handle is G-A-B-L-O-B-B, so Gablob, he wrote this: "I remember all the food in Babette's Feast being gross. Just looked it up. Yep, still gross." So I had to like research the menu and is he onto something here? Here's what we have. Here's what's served in that climactic meal: turtle soup. Now, we've already established, Adam, I enjoy eating swamp creatures, so okay by me. French champagne, of course. Who's going to argue with that? Rum cake. You know, I'm not a dessert guy. I'm not a sweets guy, but rum cake is on the list of what I do enjoy. And here's the main dish. It's Kai de Sarcophage. It's basically stuffed quails in puff pastry. I'm sorry, Gabriel, but it sounds good to me. Watching some parts of the movie again looks good to me. So Babette's Feast did make my list. It was the winner of the Best Foreign Language Oscar at the time.
Top five food movies I need to see. Babette's Feast remains at the top of the list. But fortunately for me, that's not the list we're doing here on this show. I think I've maybe mentioned this before, but you had me at Rum Cake. You know that unlike you, and more like your wife, Debbie, when we go out, Debbie and I usually get together on
the desserts. Indeed.
That's right. And I love Rum Cake so much. I didn't know it until I was in college. And my senior year, I had to take Latin. And I do say had to take because I had to fulfill a foreign language requirement. And of course, I waited until my senior year to do it. So crammed in four semesters of Latin into two semesters. No, I remember nothing. But when we would take exams, my Latin prof would bring in Rum Cake. Mm. And I almost looked forward to the test, Josh, just to eat the Rum Cake. Well, we're going to go for my number three from your rich French cuisine to not so rich classic American cuisine, and it's the all-you-can-eat buffet in the Florida Project.
Oh no!
So you've got Mooney, the six-year-old girl Mooney, and her mother Haley. Haley is treating her six-year-old daughter to this swanky hotel's all-you-can-eat breakfast buffet, and no, they're not staying there. This is actually the second time in the movie where she's taken Mooney to an all-you-can-eat scenario. The first one's at a local diner where they just don't really intend to pay for the food. Here, they pretend that they are staying at the resort and get away with it. And here's the thing. Not only am I a dessert guy, and we will get to that on this list, but I'm a breakfast all day, every day kind of guy. I can do it every meal. There is nothing better for me than bacon, pancakes, waffles, bacon, French toast, sausage, hash browns, bacon, eggs, bacon.
Yeah.
Did I mention bacon?
I think that's the key.
Okay. I said maybe I wasn't that into meat. I'm into bacon. I might even throw some fruit into the mix, Josh, like little Mooney does.
I'm going to eat a strawberry and a raspberry at the same time. Man, oh man, that's gross. I wish they made forks out candy.
The food here, you talk about the cinematography, the food is not the focus. We barely see it. It is enough to appreciate it through Mooney. The camera is on her almost the entire time in close-up, actually more of an extreme close-up. There's no depth of field. We're only looking at Mooney and the experience she's having putting all of this delicious food. Pudding is putting it nicely. All this food she's jamming into her mouth. And Sean Baker and the DP, Alexa Zabe, they even let her kind of move forward in and out of the frame, going slightly out of focus or leaning back in. And you realize that it really is the mom's point of view, watching her daughter play. That's what she's really doing with this food. She's playing, and it's Mooney playing for her mother. It's Mooney kind of putting on a show for her, but we're in the mother's eyes. We get to see it as if it's a show for us. And I love her curiosity. The way Mooney says that she's going to try strawberries and raspberries at the same time, that experiment doesn't go so well for her. She goes full Wonka at one point. She wishes the forks were edible too. And she actually wishes for a bigger stomach as we get these jump cuts as she's trying different things. And actually that fantasy element, of course, is such a key part of the movie, The Florida Project, set against the backdrop of Disneyland. And I love that closing line. She says,
"This is the life, man. Better than a cruise."
Indeed it is, Mooney. Indeed it is. Brooklyn Prince, so incredible in that scene and in the whole movie. But that's a dream scenario for me, Josh, to be able to indulge in that type of breakfast spread with no repercussions, at least maybe on the pocketbook. But there's another moment in there I want to mention as the scene is coming to a close. The mom giving her room number, the fake room number, to the woman who comes around asking for it. And you get Mooney's silence. But the camera shows her seeing and hearing what's happening and hearing the woman asking other people for their number. And the mom gives Mooney a little wink with a smile on her face. And that kind of gets at the whole core of the Florida Project, where there is genuine love and affection and playfulness between mother and daughter, but it's also kind of our little secret. You know, it's tinged with this harsh truth of this life, a life where they spend a fair amount of their time worrying about what they're going to eat. And indulgences like this are few and far between. There are all sorts of these types of secrets and negotiations that a six-year-old girl should not have to be burdened with. And in the mom's eyes, and this comes at a point in the movie where they're really at a low point, and the mom is certainly engaging in some bad behavior that is really putting Mooney at risk. And so the reward, or the way the mom almost justifies it, is through excursions like this. As occasional as they might be, it's these types of rewards. And little Mooney isn't old enough to make this decision for herself, but with her mom, she is going to be able to participate in fantasies like this one.
Well, the scene also, you know, helps delineate the movie's concern about the gap between the haves and the have-nots. I mean, can you think of a more, I don't know if it was invented in the United States, but can you think of a more American meal than the buffet, right?
Nope.
And so here's this idea that this one resort, you know, a couple doors down from where they live, has more food that anyone could possibly eat that morning. It is going to be, if not, you know, to your dream, Adam, turned over to lunch and then dinner, it's going to be thrown away. So yep. Why shouldn't these two people who are struggling to find meals, be able to come in and eat it? So I think it serves that purpose too. It also reminds me, you don't want to do this at our age, Adam, because even when I was as young as Mooney, I remember, I don't know if they had these in Iowa, but in the southwest suburbs of Chicago, they had a place called Shakey's. And it was, okay. So
I've been there once, I think.
Well, that's the number of times anyone should ever go to Shakey's. I would actually eat so much as a kid at Shakey's, I would be ill. Like when we went home at night, like I just could not stop eating the pizza and the potatoes and the fries and the what. It was like what you're describing. Like I could not believe this was all available to me, and I would be physically sick at the end of the night. So it was a little bit, you know, I don't know. Was Shakey's competing with Pizza Ranch over there in Iowa?
Beat me to it, Josh. You beat me to it. I was going to say we didn't have Shakey's in Iowa. We had the Pizza Ranch. We had the Pizza Ranch, which gave us that type of buffet, Josh, good. Of course.
I'm glad you didn't miss out.
I don't know, though, your description of how you indulge at Shakey's feels to me, sounds to me like a recommendation. I'm thinking sponsorship.
I'm sure. I think they'd love to have me give my first person experiences.
Top five movie meals brought to you by Shakey's.
All right. Our main course, that's still ahead. We're going to get to our two top choices for favorite movie meals when we come back. Plus, it's the Sweet 16 in Film Spotting Madness, and I'll have a few thoughts on the recently concluded WandaVision. Stay with us.
This is our home now. I want us to fit in.
Oh, this is gonna be a gas!
Where did you two move from?
You're listening to Film Spotting. That was Paul Bettany, Elizabeth Olsen, and national treasure Catherine Hahn in the trailer for Marvel's WandaVision. It just ended its 9-episode run on Disney Plus. Now, Josh, I have actually read the Marvel comic Vision, written by friend of the show Tom King. This is not that. As far as I know, not even really inspired by it, except maybe partially the cover of that comic book. And I loved it, but I have not watched WandaVision. I have only seen the discourse filling up my timeline on social media. I'd like you to explain this to me like I just woke up from a 10-year nap.
Way too much discourse over WandaVision. I will say that. And yes, it is distinct from Tom King's very, very good run for Marvel Comics. Similar setting, you know, this suburban setting. Mm-hmm. And some of the imagery, they had to have been inspired by King's work, both the narrative and the art that accompanied his story. I like this. I mean, I would put it, you know, I think we've done MCU ranked at one point or another. I would put it probably squarely into the middle to a little closer to the top. It was enjoyable. I'm glad I watched it. The basic setup is that Elizabeth Olsen's character, Wanda Maximoff, is, I don't want to give too much away. Basically, she and Vision, it opens where they find themselves in these very familiar sitcom scenarios of suburban American suburban life. So the first episode is a riff on the Dick Van Dyke Show. And then we move on through the decades. So we get a 60s sitcom. We get a 70s sitcom in the first couple of episodes. I absolutely loved those. It was just an interesting conceit. It seemed kind of not risky. You know, Disney can do whatever they want. Nothing's going to really be risky. But it seemed like they didn't have to do something as inventive as this. I'll say that. So I was intrigued by that. The way the filmmakers, the showrunners in production design and costumes and even camera work and editing mimicked each decade's distinct sitcom style was fascinating to me. They just did it so well. And the way that Olsen and Bettany and even Catherine Hahn, who plays this kind of nosy neighbor, mimic the performance styles of each decade and transition from that was impressive while still layering it with this undercurrent of the characters we know from the MCU films. Now, as the series expands, it needs to incorporate the larger MCU. So we leave this sort of, we get the explanations for what's going on here. I'm glad they tied what we realize with sitcoms in a direct way. So it wasn't just a gimmick, but it still gets to be a little MCU syndication feel where we're in a familiar universe. They're hitting the same beats. There's colored light battles in the air. And it just did eventually lose my interest to that end. So starts out really strong, necessarily fades in a way I kind of expected, but maybe fades too much more than it needed to. So yeah, I don't know, as someone who has, you know, an equally ambivalent relationship to the MCU, if it's something you need to feel like you missed out on all that much. But there are definitely some qualities to recommend it.
Well, however it is or isn't inspired by Tom King's run, I did love that, as I mentioned, and it made me curious about this, especially because I do love Elizabeth Olsen and have always been a Paul Bettany fan.
Yeah, and as I said, they're both great. Olsen particularly, I haven't seen everything she's done since Martha Marcy May Marlene, but from what I have seen, this is like she's on that level again. This gives her the opportunity to do that level of layered work, which is something else I was grateful for.
Well, I don't know if I was quite ready for the layered work of WandaVision, and I'm not sure when I will be ready. Meanwhile, I'll give you my TV review. I finally caught up with Ted Lasso, starring Jason Sudeikis.
So fun, right?
And guess what? My review is that everything the world has said about it is true.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, it's rare when something actually lives up to the hype.
Sure.
Something that nobody has said an unkind word about. And if the discourse actually does have some unkind words, Josh, I prefer to live in ignorance because it's a blast.
I agree with you. Yeah, it's an absolute delight. And I'm sure we will find out in the next few months why it is the worst thing the universe has ever seen.
Yeah, it has to come back around. Next week on the show, we'll have Oscar nominations to grouse about. The nominations will be announced on Monday the 15th, and then we'll get to that Oscar ceremony on April 25th because the 2020 movie year will never end.
Mm.
Also next week, right now, it looks like we're going to get back to our 7 from 76 Best Year Ever series. We have so far talked about All the President's Men. That went very well.
Mm-hmm.
Very cordial. We talked about Taxi Driver. Also went very well.
Yes.
Very cordial. We could now move on to either Network, in which case we risk you not properly appreciating one of my favorite movies of all time.
Which I'm not sure I've entirely seen yet. I still don't know.
Right.
Until I watch it, I'll know if
exactly.
I've seen this whole movie.
Yes. Yeah, we're at that age, Josh, where that happens. Or we could go toe-to-toe, Apollo Creed, Rocky Balboa style.
Oh, boy.
And talk about the movie that did win Best Picture, speaking of the Oscars, didn't it?
I don't know.
Rocky.
Sure. Of course it
know.
Did.
Now,
it
in probably this scenario, did. In this scenario, I would be Apollo Creed because I have no ill feelings towards Rocky. At least I never had growing up with the movie and adoring it. Mm-hmm. I probably haven't seen it since I was in junior high. Meanwhile, you're not a fan. So you're the Italian Stallion. You're the underdog in this case, Josh.
Oh, yeah.
Who will be going against me in conventional wisdom, perhaps.
Well, and so that's the question. Like, when do I want to take my Rocky pummeling? Do I feel like I'm psychologically ready to hear all the irate responses to my unappreciation for Rocky? Maybe it'll shift. I mean, I'm going to watch the movie again. I'm going to give it a chance. You know, Rocky Balboa, 2006, big fan. I mean, I'm not entirely anti-Rocky. I do like it because I think it repudiates a little bit about what Rocky was all about, but still, I'll give the first movie a chance. I don't expect it to go well. I expect to be like, this is going to be my Michael Phillips and Raiders of the Lost Ark experience. I'm already preparing myself. So maybe we should just get it over with. Maybe I should just flush it out, you know?
I actually, listening to you, was going to suggest we go the other way. Maybe we keep Rocky off the schedule for another month. We'll get to it around Oscar ceremony time.
Mm-hmm.
And let's go ahead and give Network its reckoning.
That's fine with me. I can do that too.
Okay. Those two movies were the films tied for the most nominations back in 1976, 10 of them. And yes, Rocky did in fact win Best Picture. We'll also have the third film in our 40s noir marathon, 1944's Laura, directed by Otto Preminger. That just stars Gene Tierney and Dana Andrews. I don't think you can say anything heretical about them like you did Veronica Lake, Josh. So there will be no fireworks.
Okay, we'll see. Don't ever bet on that, Adam.
I should have learned by now not to bet on that. This week on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, it's Hard Water Part 2, Lee Isaac Chung's Minari, which was paired with the 1986 French film Jean de Florette. And then, Josh, they're going to pair Raya and the Last Dragon with 1982's The Last Unicorn.
Oh my goodness.
Have you seen Raya yet? And have you ever seen The Last Unicorn? It's not ringing a bell with me at all.
No, though I'm thinking it had to be something my younger sisters went wild for in 82, though they would have probably been too young at that stage. Yeah, so no, an 80s movie that I'm assuming is not in Film Spotting Madness, 1980s.
It's not. So, it's not.
Wow, The Last Unicorn. I'm going to have to do a little research. Interesting.
Yeah, me too. The Next Picture Show is hosted by Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes post every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts. Now, Josh, if you're so inclined, one way you can support Film Spotting is by joining the Film Spotting family over on Patreon. You get a lot of benefits for $5 a month, ad-free episodes, a merch discount, early show downloads. You get monthly bonus episodes. We have one that we're going to be recording coming up here in the next week or so. You get access to our exclusive monthly trivia spotting events. The next one is coming up March 19th, Trivia Spotting 1984 in honor of Film Spotting Madness. It's an all 80s edition of trivia. I can't wait for that. Mm-hmm. And then you do also have the opportunity to join us for our virtual watches. We had our second one just this past weekend. We did watch Top Gun. Me, you, producer Sam Van Halgren, with a bunch of listeners. How did you think it went?
I mean, I'm kind of doing victory laps, Adam. I feel really good about the repudiation of
dare
Mav
you.
And the reclaiming of Iceman as the true hero of Top Gun. I've got I've got the polls to prove it.
I don't think they knew what they were voting in.
Oh, my gosh.
I seriously don't.
Oh, my gosh.
I think there was a lot of confusion, Josh. I have two things.
Whatever you have to tell yourself.
I have to clear the air.
Here we go.
I have to get something off my chest. Two things. One, we got to a point late in Top Gun where I mentioned something I remembered my dad saying to me at a point watching Top Gun with me, which is where we see Maverick toss some dog tags into the ocean. Because, you know, he's unburdened himself of the psychological demons associated with those dog tags or whatever. And I noted how my father said, I can't believe he tossed those into the ocean. He has a son. Goose had a son. Why wouldn't he give those to him instead of just tossing them away? And a listener noted in the chat that he thought it was his father's dog tags. And, you know, he's got the ghosts of his father and his reputation. That's also a major storyline in Top Gun. And it kind of blew my mind for a second. And it's already hard enough to think clearly in this scenario, Josh. I don't know about you, where you're watching a movie and talking about it with two other people while people are watching you, a movie you haven't seen in its entirety in like 30 years. And it's surreal enough. So I was flustered by it. But of course I was right. The listener is wrong. Those are Goose's dog tags. And you know that because when they're in the air during that last big combat scene, he's hanging on to the dog tags and he says, "Talk to me, Goose. Talk to me," before he re-engages in the battle. So they're definitely Goose's. So that's issue number one. Issue number two.
Go ahead. Should just say further confirms Mav as the villain because he's destroying evidence at that point.
Okay, fair enough.
That he killed Goose.
Okay.
Oh, spoiler. Oh my gosh. What did I just do?
So this will kind of tie nicely to my second point. I was looking up some details about the scene that started our whole argument, the one where Goose dies, which I didn't intend for it to go
in that direction. Please don't do this again.
At all. Here's all I'm going to say.
A second by second breakdown. We already sat through this.
No, Josh, you won't get it. But I just want to note that I was looking up some information just to make sure I remembered the scene correctly. And the first Google result that comes up is a Screen Rant article that says why Iceman really killed Goose. Basically, why Maverick should feel no guilt. And guess what? They do lay it out line by line, moment by moment. And it's completely correct. But here's the thing. You've got a really great take on Top Gun. You've got a really interesting take on Top Gun and on Iceman in particular. It's just a take that in order for it to be true, requires you to drastically overestimate Iceman's selflessness while simultaneously dramatically overestimating Maverick's selfishness.
Adam,
you got to meet in the middle somewhere.
I feel like we are relitigating election results that came out months ago.
My letterboxd review is coming out soon.
The courts have thrown this out. The poll results are clear.
I demand a recount.
Iceman also won the Tooth-Off poll. I mean,
that's
come
true.
On, right?
Yeah, it's serious film criticism going on in these virtual watches. We did have a Tooth-Off. We renamed Tony Scott Tonguey Scott.
Oh, a lot of tongue in this movie.
A lot of tongue. So hopefully it sounds like we had fun, because we did.
Adam, next poll, steak. Medium or medium rare? You're going to lose that one too.
So do you think that's true? Josh, I do know that there is conventional wisdom that says the more rare you go, the better the steak is. Don't overcook it. But do you think that most people really do like it pretty bloody?
I don't. There's only one way to find out.
Okay, it's happening.
Film spotting poll.
Filmspotting.net. Where the most important life questions will be answered. That is going on the main page this week. Tell us, please. I mean, Josh, you're making it sound like I said I wanted my steak well done. I think medium's a pretty good temperature.
Obviously you do. This will make you correct.
Patreon.com/filmspotting.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
This is absolute madness.
This madness.
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
Because there's not enough madness already on the show, it's time for Film Spotting Madness Best of the 1980s, Round 2 results, and the Sweet 16 matchups. For any newcomers, it's our 7th annual bracket-style tournament. 64 movies, only one survives. We are looking at only films of the 1980s in this tournament, and the Sweet 16 voting is currently live at filmspotting.net/madness. Voting closes Monday, March 15th at 11 a.m. Central Time. Let's take a look then, Josh, at the bracket, see how the round two contest played out, and see what's ahead in the Sweet 16. We start with Raging Bull beating Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, 57% to 43%. Closer than I would have thought, actually.
Oh,
for
me too. Totally.
A top seed in this tournament in Raging Bull. John Carpenter's The Thing. How about this? Taking down my beloved Pantheon movie, David Lynch's Blue Velvet, the closest round two contest, 51% to 49%. And if you wonder why we engage in all this silliness sometimes, well, here's Big Dan T, a listener who says, the only good to come of this is that I'm off to rewatch both movies right now. Well, see, we did our work, Josh.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is one I got wrong, actually. I mean, it was a tough prediction to make, but I figured these two would face off. Didn't know which way it would go. Didn't predict that Lynch would go down.
Wow. The Sweet 16 matchup then is Raging Bull versus The Thing. Could The Thing have another upset in it? That John Carpenter film, could it take down Martin Scorsese's classic? That brings us to our next set, Josh.
All right, we have This Is Spinal Tap over E.T. An
what?
Upset. This Is Spinal Tap. Rob Reiner takes down Spielberg and E.T. 52% to 48%. The only reason this doesn't break my heart is that I kind of predicted this would happen.
And how did you do that? Josh, I want to know, because I, of course, predicted E.T. would win. I sound like I'm exasperated. I'm just shocked. I love E.T. I do favor Spinal Tap over it, so it got my vote. But in terms of what I predicted, I thought E.T. might have a Final Four run in it. How did you know Spinal Tap would win?
I will tell you. I think this is the second instance, I forget what the first one was, where you yourself, Adam Kempinar, have underestimated the Adam influence.
Got it. See, now you're just trying to pump my tires, trying to make me feel better after the whole Top Gun thing. And I will take it, Josh.
All right. Amadeus matched up against When Harry Met Sally in this round. And who do you think took it here? It was Amadeus with 60% of the vote. So that means This Is Spinal Tap versus Amadeus. This is, we'll get to it probably, Adam, but this has got to be a killer for you, Adam, which way you're going to go.
Yes and no. It continues to be a killer, but I've already had to answer it at least twice on the show before. And so just to try and be consistent, I am going to go the same way the third time that I've gone previously. We did our top five films of 1984 several years ago here on the show. I had to decide which movie I actually cared about more. And I love them both so much. They were my one and two. This Is Spinal Tap or Amadeus. I went with Spinal Tap. We then had to re-rank our favorite films of 1984 after we did our 8 from 84 series last year. We talked about Amadeus and This Is Spinal Tap. And I stuck with Spinal Tap, just edging out Amadeus. So Josh, I'm not going to change it up now. As much as it kills me again, because I love Amadeus so much, I'm going to give Spinal Tap the slight edge. I'm going to vote for it. I have a feeling you're going to go Amadeus. What do you think listeners will do?
Oh, man. My prediction is Spinal Tap. I'm just looking at my chart there for a minute. Yeah, my prediction is Spinal Tap. And I feel bad now because I appreciate your integrity, but I am voting personally in this one, Amadeus, even though my 8 from 84 ranking has Spinal Tap ahead. And I guess my thinking this time, it's very close. I mean, they're both 3.5 out of 4 stars on my website. Revisited both recently to great appreciation. I think when I just voted today, I thought about, and we talked about this, the music. Am I going to go metal or am I going to go Mozart? I'm sorry.
maybe a little unfair. Bad metal,
I'm
parody
sorry.
Metal versus Mozart.
Well, as I said, metal and Mozart. So for me, you know, I'm going to preserve the music of Mozart. I think I'm going to contradict myself and vote that way here.
I mean, you can hear Mozart in all sorts of different places and platforms, Josh, but Big Bottom can only come to you via the magic of This Is Spinal Tap.
Needs to be burnt.
It's not going in the incinerator. I think it might advance. I do just want to mention here, I got both of these wrong. I think I only got maybe 3 wrong this round. I got both of these wrong. I thought E.T. would win, and I thought When Harry Met Sally, everyone tells me how beloved that 80s movie is. I thought it would take down Amadeus. It didn't happen. Okay.
Adam, how many times have we talked about When Harry Met Sally on this show?
0.
There you go.
The Shining went up against A Fish Called Wanda, and it wasn't much of a contest, 77% to 23%. This one was closer, The Terminator over Ferris Bueller's Day Off, 53 to 47%.
We got a comment from Bruce McClintock. How am I supposed to choose between these two movies? One is about an unstoppable force that uses stolen cars and voice mimicry in a relentless pursuit of his primary objective, and the other is about a Terminator. I chose The Terminator. Colin Deak had similar thoughts. One features a sociopathic monster unleashed upon the 80s, threatening to destroy humanity's last hope for the future. The other, of course, stars Arnold Schwarzenegger. Colin says, I feel like I'm stealing this from John Hodgman, but can't find the quote. And both of these comments, Adam, speak to my reservation about Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I feel like a lot of people have rewatched this movie since they were younger and find Ferris just insufferable. And I just want him to remain my personal hero in my mind.
Well, based on those comments, very funny, guys. I think Bruce and Colin should obviously get together and go bowling. The Sweet 16 matchup then is The Terminator v. The Shining. We have another unstoppable kind of force in Jack Torrance, or The Shining itself, I suppose, up against The Terminator. Josh, this one's pretty easy for me. I'm going to go with The Shining here. What about you?
Yeah, The Shining for me, absolutely. All right, our next matchup was Blade Runner versus Stop Making Sense. Blade Runner took it pretty handily, 71% to 29%. Jonathan Anderson in Denver, oh no, I only just discovered Stop Making Sense last year, and now it's going to be gone like tears in rain.
Die Hard went up against Raising Arizona, little closer, but not much. 62% for Die Hard, only 38% for Raising Arizona. Brent Lambert-Zafino said, I need Raising Arizona to win, or Film Spotting Madness will become a rocky place where my vote can find no purchase.
Aaron Newirth chimed in, being made to vote against the Coen brothers is not my idea of fun. Once again, regretting getting so involved. Yippee-ki-yay, no thank you, Mother Madness. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if the cadence works out there, but I see what you're going for, Aaron.
Yeah. The Sweet 16 matchup then is a tough one. It was really tough for me. Maybe the toughest. Well, no, the second toughest, I think, of the Sweet 16. Blade Runner v. Die Hard, one of the best sci-fi neo-noirs ever, against maybe the best action movie ever. Josh, who are you picking?
Yeah, you just set the terms that I considered. And I've used these, I think I used these possibly with Blade Runner. I would say it's like 1A, great sci-fi.
Right, against the concert movie.
Yeah, Die Hard is like one, like just clear number one action movie. So I've, as much as I love both, I got to go Die Hard.
Yeah, you did use that reasoning with Stop Making Sense, the concert movie,
there
maybe
you go.
The best ever, right? So you voted for it, and now here again, voting against Roy Batty and Deckard in Blade Runner, and I'm with you. I'm voting Die Hard.
Nice. Next matchup, Raiders of the Lost Ark versus Poor But Kind and Gentle, I'm assuming, Cinema Paradiso, 85% to 15% Raiders takes it. And then we had Aliens versus Full Metal Jacket. Aliens won that as well, 64% to 36%.
Again, an actual Vietnam movie against James Cameron's Vietnam movie. Mitchell Bupre says, one of these movies effectively captures the terror of going into an unknown territory with the biggest, baddest weaponry possible, all of the hubris of Americans thinking they can storm in anywhere and take over, only to be met with a force they couldn't possibly have prepared for. It manages to portray not only the horrors of Vietnam, but also the folly of an invading force underestimating their opponent, a historical event that we've seen countless times in the real world and in cinema. Wait for it. The other is Full Metal Jacket. So this joke construction, we might have to throw it out.
Maybe in the incinerator.
That means, Josh, that Raiders of the Lost Ark is going up against Aliens.
Mm-hmm.
Probably pretty easy for both of us. Raiders?
Yeah. I mean, I'm no Michael Phillips.
Exactly. You've got the stubble, though. Reminds me of Michael sometimes.
Okay,
not
good.
The full beard, Josh. We have then Back to the Future up against Kurosawa's Ron. 72%. For Robert Zemeckis and Marty McFly. Isabel Bishop says, I will fling myself into the sun if the garbage fire that is Back to the Future beats the masterpiece that is Ron.
Oh.
I mean, I know where she's coming from.
What? You do?
I mean, at least in her praise for Ron. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, I've got to hear more about the garbage fire bit, and I'm curious. All right, The Princess Bride faced off against Burton's Beetlejuice. I kind of like this matchup, actually. But there wasn't much of a competition. Princess Bride takes it with 72% of the vote to 28%.
Okay, now I can't say this too loudly because my wife will get very angry with me if she hears that it was actually a tough choice. But the Sweet 16 matchup then is Back to the Future versus The Princess Bride. The Princess Bride, the first movie I ever watched with my eventual bride.
Oh, wow.
A movie I adore, as everyone should.
Don't do it. Don't vote against it, Adam.
I did want to be Marty McFly at one point
in
my life.
Who cares?
Who cares? Indeed, The Princess Bride is my pick.
Thank you. Good move. I'm glad I just made things a lot smoother for you in the next
happiness.
Week. Smart man. All right. Next matchup was Do the Right Thing versus The Right Stuff. Do the Right Thing took it with 84% of the vote. Ghostbusters then in this round was against Dead Poets Society, and Ghostbusters won handily. So that gives us a sweet 16 matchup of Ghostbusters versus Do the Right Thing.
I mean, maybe the easiest one of the round. I love Ghostbusters. We talked about it last year, but it's Do the Right Thing.
It is.
That brings us to our final set here. My Neighbor Totoro over the Coen Brothers debut Blood Simple. The Coen Brothers are out completely of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 80s, 55% to 45%.
Close though, huh? Pretty close.
Yeah. Yeah.
Empire Strikes Back takes out Martin Scorsese's The King of Comedy, 78% to 22%. Here's Jared Young. Oh, sweet Lord, I can see an Empire-Totoro matchup looming on the horizon. This is going to tear our household apart. Excuse me while I go full Michael Shannon and build a take shelter-style bunker to protect my family from this imminent disaster. Jared, yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
Now, we alluded to this matchup as well coming on the horizon when we began Madness. I know that there is a lot of love out there, and rightfully so, for Miyazaki's My Neighbor Totoro. Is there any world, though, Josh, where it actually takes down The Empire Strikes Back?
There is in my world, Adam. I like to joke that I'm flippant about Madness, make most of my choices in 3 seconds, and move on. This is where I'm regretting the entire enterprise for a number of years now that we ever engaged in this, that I'm forced to choose between these two movies. You've got your best Star Wars versus maybe your best Miyazaki. I don't know if I have it ranked up there right now. I think I might. That's my quick answer. It's the best Miyazaki. Sentimentality doesn't help me here. The family dynamic that Jared is referencing, because when I think about it, I mean, I've got a couple of years ago, probably it was, I could go into my daughter's bedroom and there would be my old Tauntaun toy that I had as a kid on a shelf right next to a stuffed Totoro. So these are like, our whole family loves these movies. Can I just let the cat bus and Wampa fight it out? Is that a way to resolve this?
Sure.
All right. So here's my decision. Both are from the 1980s. I didn't see Totoro though until I was an adult. And I know there's an eight year gap between them, but still didn't see Totoro till I was an adult. So that movie means the world to me now. And it has since the first time I saw it as an adult.
But
Empire not only means the world to me now, but it did when I was six.
Okay.
And you just can't turn your back on that sort of connection to a movie, especially when that movie removed the nostalgia factor. That movie holds up today. And Empire it is.
Without being able to explain it to myself that way, I think that's precisely why it was a pretty easy choice for me as well, Josh, to go with Empire Strikes Back. Call it nostalgia if you want, but just thinking about what that movie meant to me then and how I still feel about it.
Yes.
It is going to have the edge over My Neighbor Totoro. I can't wait to see how the results come out. So Spielberg dropped two there, E.T. and The Last Crusade out. He still does have a shot at Madness Glory with Raiders. Scorsese down to one title, Raging Bull. Kubrick down to one, The Shining. Coens, as we said, out entirely. David Lynch is out. John Hughes is out. Tim Burton is out. Is it really an 80s bracket if those guys are out? The only director with two films competing in the Madness Sweet 16, Rob Reiner.
Wow.
Princess Bride, and This is Spinal Tap.
So crazy, right? And consider that When Harry Met Sally, like, made a good run.
Had a chance.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. So let's look at the bracket contest, how it's shaping up so far. Over 800 predictions. Two of them had perfect first rounds. That's our producer, Sam, and listener, Matthew Emery. After two rounds, neither Sam nor Matthew are at the top of the leaderboard. We don't know the identity of our current leader, but the title of their prediction bracket is The Most Difficult Madness Yet? Apparently not for them. They were perfect in round two. Perfect, except for that E.T. versus Spinal Tap matchup. I know you talk about bracket busters, including hurting me, E.T. going down. Some people had it winning it all. Some people had it in the championship. The two runners-up, the people tied for second place so far, both had perfect round twos. They're well-positioned then moving forward. As far as our internal bracket contest, Sam, as we said, had the lead last week, but he had four incorrect picks in round two. Ooh. Dead Poets over Ghostbusters. Why? I don't know. And that means he slipped to second in the contest. He's still 25th overall out of over 800. That's pretty good.
Yeah, not bad.
Okay. Now, Josh, how about this? You've moved into first place.
What?
You only had one incorrect pick in round two, Blue Velvet, you said, over The Thing. And you're tied for fourth overall.
Oh, wow. This is
your year.
Uncharted territory for me.
Yep. I did have three wrong in round two. That means I've dropped to 42nd in the bracket contest. Still feel pretty good about that. Third in our internal contest. And Mike Merrigan, godfather of Film Spotting Madness, like me, had three wrong. And here's where Mike is in bad shape. He lost his pick to win the whole shebang.
Oh.
He thought Raising Arizona.
Oh.
And the love of the Coen brothers among the Film Spotting Nation would just be the tide that took him to victory. But it's not happening.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the logic. He's looking at past Film Spotting Madness history, and I get that. But I didn't go that way myself. Sorry, Mike.
Yeah. So it does mean Mike probably has an Adam Sandler movie in his future.
Hey, I'm not going to get cocky, Adam. We got a little ways to go.
Yeah, that's a good approach. Voting in the Sweet 16 round of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 80s is live. You can vote. You can leave a comment at filmspotting.net/madness. That voting closes again on Monday, March 15th at 11 a.m. Central Time. Elite 8 voting will start the afternoon of the 15th. Members of the Film Spotting family on Patreon get first shot at the polls, then our subscribers to the Film Spotting newsletter. More info at patreon.com/filmspotting and at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
In prison, dinner was always a big thing. We had a pasta course, and then we had a meat or a fish. Paulie did the prep work. He was doing a year for contempt, and he had this wonderful system for doing the garlic. He used a razor, and he used to slice it so thin that it used to liquefy in the pan with just a little oil. It was a very good system. Vinny was in charge of the tomato sauce.
We get back into our countdown of our top five movie meals with that scene, dinner in prison from Goodfellas. And that's because it's a go-to for me, Josh, anytime this topic comes up. The topic of meals in movies. Maybe it's my love of Italian food. I immediately go to Goodfellas and the description of all the meal prep. And I actually go to another mobster movie. I go to The Godfather. And the scene where Clemenza teaches a young Al Pacino, Michael, how to make a sauce, how to make his sauce in case he ever has to make a large meal for a crew of his own someday. Not eligible in this case because they are both in the Film Spotting Pantheon. Also in the Film Spotting Pantheon is Raging Bull. That means the steak. If you overcook it, Josh, it's no good. It defeats its own purpose.
I know.
It also won't make our top five movie meals. And in that case, it's not just because it's in the Pantheon, but while the scene is very memorable, I don't think either of us watch it and think, I can't wait to bite into that steak that's overcooked and is now on the floor. And wanting to sample for ourselves the delights we're seeing on screen was a huge driver for us in forming our list.
Yes, and I actually had that Goodfellas prison dinner on my list until I did the, for some reason, how many years have I been doing this now? 8 years?
Yeah, like 8 years,
it's,
nine.
It's like, oh, this is what I want to do. I should check the Pantheon. Of course, Goodfellas, as I should have known, right, is on there. Three scenes in Goodfellas you could go with, right? Not only the prison one, but making the sauce.
At the end with the helicopter and the paranoia. Helicopter.
Yeah, and then dinner at his mom's, right? She's bringing out the food for him. So, yeah,
totally.
Unfortunately, Goodfellas not eligible.
Nope. Give us then your number two movie meal.
All right. My favorite Studio Ghibli meal. You've said yours, Adam. Is the pork ramen in Ponyo? You cited it. That's really? Where I'm going. Yeah. For those who haven't seen Ponyo, Ponyo is a magical sea creature. She befriends a young boy, wills herself to become human against the wishes of her sea wizard father. So this results in all sorts of tension. That results in this tsunami, and that threatens to batter the seaside home where the boy, who's named Sasuke, lives with his mother. So as Ponyo and Sasuke, they're in the house here, they're waiting out the storm, and Sasuke's mom makes a bowl of ramen for them. A gag throughout the movie is how much Ponyo loves food, right, Adam? Especially ham. And so obviously, she's excited when it turns out to be tonkatsu ramen, which is pork ramen, my favorite kind too, actually. I love how much time and attention Hayao Miyazaki gives to the preparation of the meal here. And I think that's a common thing for a lot of the food scenes in his movies. And mm-hmm. even something like another Ghibli movie, like From Up on Poppy Hill, they give attention to the preparation and the enjoyment of the food. I think that honestly had to be an influence on Wes Anderson's team when they made Isle of Dogs and that sushi scene, which is also all about the preparation. So here, Sasuke even tells Ponyo that she's going to have to wait a few minutes for the broth to saturate the noodles. And then I just love how the movie makes us wait too. It just mm-hmm. sits there and it brings us in not only to the taste of the meal, but the experience of the meal. So thematically, this ties into the thread in the film about the children's relationships with their mothers and their fathers. Ponyo's mother comes into play too, eventually. And so I really like this quiet moment of Sasuke's mother providing for them in the storm. It's just so key.
Yeah, it really is. And I love that once again, we have nice symmetry in our picks, because my number two also employs waiting and pauses in a major way to make us appreciate the food before us. Though there's also some other things going on, including the director ramping up the tension with those pauses. So I mentioned earlier that I'm a breakfast all day, every day guy, but I'm also perfectly content to make dessert the whole meal. And I could do that for all three meals of the day as well. And this scene is so good. And the dessert looks so good. It doesn't even matter that I would never order an apple anything. It's the not so terrible apple strudel from Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds.
Avez-vous goûté le strudel ici?
Non. Il n'est pas si mauvais.
So we get the formality of it, the interruptions, the drawing out of the tension, as I mentioned, where Hans Landa sits down. He's interrogating Melanie Laurent's character. She knows that they have a past, a very tragic past. He does not know that, though he says certain things that make it seem like maybe he does. And you can see that fear in her eyes. But he orders the strudel. He forgets the cream. He stirs the espresso. The cream arrives. Every time he's about to pose a question to her or really get to the point, there's some little interruption that just elongates the scene and elongates the terror for her. I mentioned waiting for the cream. Christoph Waltz in that moment where she takes her fork and starts to take a bite of the strudel before the cream has arrived. He says, wait for the cream.
Attendez la crème.
It is perfection. And as if you weren't hungry enough, here is the waiting. The fact that Landa won't proceed without the cream, and the way Tarantino cuts to the close-ups of it being dolloped on the pastry, it just makes you think, well, this must be amazing. This cream has to be worth waiting for. And as the plate finally sits there with the cream on top, the cream he's been waiting for, Waltz then does something so wonderful. He takes a beat before plunging his fork into it just to appreciate it as it sits there. And then, of course, he goes on and punctuates the interrogation with his biting and his chewing. And this brings me back to my number three pick a little bit, the Florida Project, right? This sense of a deal kind of being made here over food, a tacit agreement, in this case, an explicit agreement to use her theater for her to handle the projection and not the black man who works for her, no matter how skilled he might be. And of course, it's more than that, too. There is something sinister going on at the core of it, though that's only known to Shoshana, she is truly making a deal with the devil, the man who slaughtered her family at the beginning of the movie. And that deal starts when she accepts the invitation to talk over strudel. She doesn't really have much of a choice, of course, but she doesn't get up and leave. She waits for the cream before she eats, just as she's been instructed to. She even accepts the cigarette and smokes the cigarette that he offers her when he's done with the strudel. She does all of that. Note the one thing she doesn't do in this scene, Josh, she doesn't take a drink of the milk that he orders on her behalf. The same drink he asks for another glass of at the beginning of the movie, just before he slaughters her family on the dairy farm. There's another great pause at the very end of the scene too, where he says, "I had another question to ask you." And then he just looks at her stone-faced, silent, and then says, "Oh, I can't think of it." And it diffuses it for a second, diffuses that terror. And then his final act is to take the cigarette out of his mouth and plunge it into the strudel. And I love that touch because it's such kind of a vulgar act for a man who's so sophisticated and so refined, but it's that German cigarette defiling the French pastry. And it just reflects his overall arrogance and sense of superiority. Like, I can enjoy this, but only to a point, you know? And Laurent is so good in the scene. The way at the very beginning of it, when he asks her a question, I think it's the first time she speaks, she says, "No, no." And the first no, she can't even get it out. She can't even fully say the word no. It's like a whisper. And after the buildup of all that tension and her barely being able to sit there with this man, when he finally leaves, that expulsion of breath and the tears that come is another great acting moment from Melanie Laurent. And it's another great Tarantino acting scene. One of my favorite parts of watching any Tarantino movie. Both the performances of Waltz and Laurent, but also Laurent as Emmanuel Mimieux, this French cinema owner and willing German collaborator, which of course she's really not. So this gets back to what I said earlier, Josh. I definitely wouldn't want to be her in this scene overall, but I'd sure like to sample that strudel.
Yeah, even if you're someone who has conflicted feelings about Inglourious Basterds, which I am, there are definite great scenes in it, and that is one of them. And related, if you're conflicted about desserts, as I am, apple strudel, it's one I like. So good pick there, Adam.
Okay, number one.
Number one, big announcement. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Phantom Thread has moved ahead. There Will Be Blood for the number two spot on my PTA ranked list.
Wow.
Yeah, it was revisiting scenes for this list, this top five that we're doing, Adam, that had me make that move. I still Punch Drunk Love, I'll give it another look, but I'm kind of holding off on giving it another look because I don't want to have to bump it down. But Phantom Thread is there at number two right now. And so many great scenes in this movie involving food. My pick from those had to be the climactic showdown / power struggle / foreplay that the movie concludes with over this wild mushroom omelet that Alma, played by Vicky Creeps, makes for Reynolds, played by Daniel Day-Lewis. Yes. All right. Full circle to my first
pick.
Here
it comes.
The omelets are also poisonous. I know, Adam. He suspects.
What's with your taste buds, Josh?
But he takes the bite anyway. Reynolds takes the bite anyway. He holds it in his mouth for a bit as they intensely stare into each other's eyes. This is such a charged scene. And I think it's, you know, it's just emblematic of the movie's themes of power, control, vulnerability, and the filmmaking here. I mean, just let's go back to this idea we've talked about, the time the scene gives to the preparation of the meal, to watching Alma make this meal. It almost unfolds in real time. It's close. Now, writing for The New Yorker in 2018, Helen Rosner called Phantom Thread the best food movie in ages. And so I'm going to let her describe the filmmaking here. The scene is shot with an almost animalistic intimacy, a play of close-up textures. The contrast between the slick metal of the knife and the dry fiber of mushrooms, the glossy blanketing tumble of finely chopped chives, and butter, not once but twice, one dense yellow knob for browning the mushrooms, and then another to grease the pan, the curds billowing up as the beaten eggs come into contact with the heat. That's Helen Rosner in The New Yorker. Hmm. And of course, we've learned from earlier in the film, Reynolds doesn't like a lot of butter in his dishes. So right away, we're seeing another power play on Alma's part. Now, Adam, on Slack, we were kind of talking about how we're going to do our lists. You scoffed at this pick because of the poisoning factor, but
yeah, just because of the poison. That little ingredient, Josh.
I don't know. I mean, I guess give me the poison. You know what? Give me everything in this movie. I want Reynolds' suits. I want his house. I want his car. I want his tea. I want his ennui. I want his misery. And yes, I want his poisoned mushroom omelet. Give it all to me, Adam.
There's some Reynolds in Josh Larson. I see it from time to time.
You think so?
I do. Okay. Great pick. A little bit of an off the beaten path pick, considering the poison part. I'm going to go with a very conventional choice, but it has to be here, Josh. And I'll say timpano is pasta with a special crust.
Mm.
And it's shaped like a drum, like a timpani drum. And inside...
all of the most important things in the world.
Only the most important things in the world. Yes, we started this segment talking about the Italian movies we couldn't include and the food they were making, Goodfellas, and The Godfather. Well, I'm going to end it with Italian. And the artist who is going to cook this dish for me is longtime listener David L. Williams.
Hi, Film Spotting. It's David L. Williams in Pennsylvania. The best movie meal, there's no question in my mind, is the giant dinner in Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott's Big Night. After the soup that looks simple but makes every diner swoon, there's the three-color risotto, green pesto, white regular, and pink seafood that looks like the flag of Italy. And how do you follow that with the timpano, this drum of pasta and meat and eggs and sauce that looks more like sculpture than food? Ian Holmes Pascal says it tastes so good he should kill the chef who made it.
God damn it! God damn it, I should kill you. This is so fucking good, I should kill you.
After that, it's all a blur. There are chickens, a whole roasted fish, probably a branzino, asparagus, beets, artichokes, grapes, tomatoes, a roast suckling pig, and wine that never stops flowing. Tony Shalhoub's Primo says, to eat good food is to be close to God, and it's hard to find a more rapturous cinematic meal than the one in Big Night.
David has a decent way with words, almost like he's a playwright or something, and he's right about timpano. Josh, who needs bread with pasta when I can have my pasta in my bread? That crust, yes. That incredible crust that is made by Tony Shalhoub, of course, his brother, played by Stanley Tucci in this great film, directed by Campbell Scott. Google timpano, and you'll find YouTube clips that show you how to make, or at least attempt to make, timpano. 6.6 million hits, so I think at least a few people have seen Big Night and been inspired enough by the preparation, by the artistry of it, by the reactions to the food, the rapturous reactions to tasting it that you see in the movie, and decided they had to give it a shot themselves. So the timpano in Big Night, something I've never seen on a menu, something that I would obviously love to try. It'll probably have to remain a fantasy for me. And yet I will acknowledge that there's at least one other really nice meal moment in Big Night right after this. At the end of the film, mm-hmm. I'll let Tim in Denver do the honors. He sent in his favorite movie meals, and he mentioned the family meal at the beginning of Tortilla Soup, based on Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Any scene in Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Tim says, here's the thing, I don't like sushi, and yet this film made me want to devour some straight away. And then he says, from Big Night, no, not that meal with the timpano and all. It's the simple omelet the Stanley Tucci character makes the next morning in the wake of the disastrous night that most pulls on my heartstrings along with my taste buds. So an omelet there, I'm guessing Stanley Tucci didn't use any poison. Maybe mushrooms.
I don't know. There is a ton of stuff in a timpano. I mean, I've never had it either. And you watch this scene and there's like, there are hard-boiled eggs in this thing. There's sausage. I would love to try it. It seems like a lot to me, but it would probably win me over. But that note about the omelet it's so true. I mean, what is it about? I obviously had one in my pick, but I like that it's popped up as this dish that is so simple. But it's more like the meaning and the effort that can be put into it, even though anyone can make it. Maybe that's what it is. That just about
universal,
anyone can make it.
But so personal and customizable, you know? Those are our top five movie meals. We hope we made you hungry. That's really the only way to test whether or not we were successful, Josh. Like, yes, watching these movies and these scenes ourselves. Did people listen to us and then want to go out and sample any of these dishes? You can hold the poison. Did you have any honorable mentions, Josh?
Yeah, as I said, we got a lot of great responses, which made up some of my honorable mentions. So I want to go to some of those here. First of all, a blind spot confession for me, Tempopo came up a lot. Still not one that I've seen. I know I should. I know it's one of those great food movies. Just wasn't able to get to it. Some people might be wondering why Ratatouille, the Pixar film, is not on my list. Here's a case where I've had Ratatouille. I don't really love it. I mean, it's just not a fond dish for me. We're back to omelets here. I did consider the omelet that Remy makes for Linguini. That's probably my number six. I didn't want to have two omelets, though, on my list. A lot of people mentioned the egg sandwich that Adam Sandler makes in Spanglish. And yes, I fondly remember that one. And I do love my egg sandwiches. I know you do as well, Adam. Mm-hmm. The one in Birds of Prey we highlighted from last year.
Egg, bacon, American cheese, soft, toasted, buttered roll. Just a dash of hot sauce.
Not too much, Sal. I want to taste the cheese.
How about this? Did you think at all about the Daisy's Dinner? So our Overlooked Auteurs marathon, we saw Daisy's, the film from Czech filmmaker Vera Chitlova. I watched that scene again, thinking about it, of Marie 1 and 2 on that hilarious dinner date with the older man. But honestly, the food did not look great. I mean, this is the scene where Chitlova starts changing the colors. So the frame goes from pink to blue and green. And it wasn't really appetizing. Do we want to anger the 90s kids? Of course we do. A lot of people mentioned the make-believe meal in Hook. I'm gonna stay on brand, Adam, and say it looks terrible. stale Play-Doh.
Yeah. Josh, you know what? I actually have it as an honorable mention.
Oh,
I was
going to
make nice with the 90s kids.
Come on.
I was going to say it because it doesn't work. That's why it couldn't get anywhere near my list, really, because no, I'm not interested in any of the food we actually do see. But that's still the best scene in Hook. You have to give it that.
Now, stay on my side, Adam. Come on. We have to stay united on this.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
One more. Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. I mean, I'm having an issue, Adam, because there's a White Castle way too close to our new place where we moved. It's kind of been a problem.
Okay, so confession time. I have never seen Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. And also, even though I've now lived in Illinois for...
Oh, no.
Coming up on 20 years.
Oh,
and in fact,
don't say
for
it.
The first, no, I'm going to say it. For the first 16 of those years, I more or less drove by a White Castle every day. I have never had it.
Adam, I think you'll like it because the meat product that they provide, I believe it's cooked medium.
Okay. You got me, Josh. As long as it's not well done or, you know, medium rare. Okay, I mentioned desserts. So honorable mention. How about I Want Candy? That sequence from Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, Petit
great.
Fours, Millefeuze, Cannelle. I probably
love
butchered
it.
All of those. I just know they look really tasty, those Lotterie desserts. We talked about it during our 8 from 84 series, maybe the only scene in the movie I truly loved, the Charlotte Russe scene from Once Upon a Time in America. The film crew feast that Penelope Cruz prepares in the Almodovar film Volver.
Oh, great pick. Yes.
Is one I thought about, and way too many to name from the Trip series, of course. Dylan Dom in Blair, Nebraska. I'm going to close with this, even though you never actually see the food that I can recall, but I had completely forgotten about this scene, and we'll link to it in our show notes and on our top five page if you want to see it, or you can just Google it. Dylan Dom, Blair, Nebraska says the first one that I thought of probably doesn't qualify because we don't see the food, but it has to be the greatest meal order in movie history. It's Margaret Brown, the late Margaret Brown in Hell or High Water, taking the order and saying, "What don't you want?" And her explanation of the only thing they really have on the menu is T-bone steaks. I don't know if they talk about the temperature or not, Josh. Let's go ahead and let's just end that.
Okay.
End that debate here for now anyway. But it's a great scene. Again, I'll link to it in our show notes over at filmspotting.net. And on our top five page, you can get there by going to filmspotting.net/lists. Josh, I'm hungry. That's our show.
Yeah, I'm so glad we recorded this one a little later, after dinner. Otherwise, I would have been really suffering. If you want to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter, Adam is at FilmSpotting. I'm at Larson on Film. In the show archives over at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. And you can vote in the Sweet 16 round of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 80s. To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out in limited release this weekend, The Human Voice. We'll mention Pedro Almodovar again. It's his short film adaptation of a one-act play by Jean Cocteau. It stars Tilda Swinton, also coming up on our top five. That's at The Music Box. Next week here on the show, we will have the Oscar nominations to talk about. Those will be announced on Monday the 15th. We'll return to our 7 from 76 Best Year Ever series. We're going to talk about 10-time Oscar nominee Network, written by Patty Chayefsky, directed by Sidney Lumet. And we'll talk about Laura, directed by Otto Preminger, the second movie in our 40s noir marathon.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogeren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Kat Sullivan. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.